This is a recording of a live Resolution Foundation event. We hope you find it some combination of interesting or entertaining. To read the research and access the event slides referenced in this episode, please visit the events section of our website. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this Resolution Foundation webinar. My name is Torsten Bell. I'm the Chief Executive of the Foundation. Now, I know you're all sitting at home or in Downing Street waiting for Sue Gray's report, but given that it probably isn't going to turn up in the next half an hour, this is like top distraction tactics to keep you all busy through the morning. And here we're going to talk about something that you might have to wait a little bit longer for than Sue Gray's report slash them and probably the Metropolitan Police's response and whatever Tory MPs decide to do, which is what is going to be the eventual outcome of the government's pivot of trade policy away from a huge enthusiasm for a US trade deal towards the Indo-Pacific region and then sub-deals within that region to deliver that pivot over the coming years. That's currently the intention, the strategy that is being laid out. And what we want to talk about today is how should we think about that strategy? What would that mean in terms of how your trade strategy interacts with the country's wider economic strategies? Is it achievable? Is any of this ever going to happen? What's the relative importance of the subcomponents of that pivot? So that is the plan today. We're obviously doing that under the umbrella of our and LSE's Economy 2030 inquiry, looking at the future of the UK's economic strategy in the face of economic change during the 2020s. And as always, I should say thank you to the Nuffield Foundation for funding that project. And today is on the back of a report written by Sophie Hale, one of our principal economists here, which you can look up on the website. And she's going to kick us off with a presentation of the summary of those findings. And then we've got a great panel to help us unpick something which I have to say overall, given that we haven't been running a trade policy for 4 decades really, and given that most of what we've been doing in recent years has been kind of stopping really bad things happening, given that a big change has happened, like rolling over existing trade agreements, we're now getting into the what do we actually want to do phase. Maybe this is overly optimistic, but kind of we're getting towards the what do we actually want to do phase of trade policy. So we've got a great panel to discuss that. So first of all, we're going to hear from John Alty, who until recently was the Permanent Secretary of the Department for International Trade and before that, the Director General of Trade Policy, since July 2016, so basically from the beginning. Then you can hear from Anna Isaacs, who's an economics editor at The Independent, has been doing great work reporting on trade and the global economy, actually, there, prior to being elevated to be economics editor in the recent past. So congratulations on your elevation, Anna, and bad luck for the rest of us that now get less of you focused on pure trade stuff. And then Sally Jones, who's the UK trade strategy and Brexit leader at Ernst & Young. So that's a nice small job to do. And Sally hopefully is going to make sure that we don't forget what business is actually looking for from these trade deals when in, you know, we're about to show you a lot of charts. There's a lot of spreadsheets, but we'll get a bit of what business actually wants out of this, what the barriers actually might already be for business when we're talking about trade with India in particular. So that is the plan. As always, you can ask questions, please do. We're on Slido. The hashtag is trade pivot, because it's all about where are we going to pivot to, given that we've decided we're going to pivot somewhere. And there'll be a few polls in there over the course of the session. So that's the plan this morning. Sophie, kick us off.
Great. Okay, so first of all, I'm just going to kind of set out the context for this paper that Torsten kind of has already alluded to a little bit. The UK government wants to keep the UK as a kind of big open trading country. It has this kind of global Britain agenda, and it's looking for new opportunities for UK exporters overseas, you know, having kind of left the EU and kind of erected some barriers with EU trading partners. So the question that it kind of remains for, you know, the direction of the trade strategy is where do we pivot towards? So the original strategy was kind of orientated around this big US deal. The US is our sort of second largest trading partner after the EU. And although those negotiations kind of got off to a good start with the change of administration, a deal between the UK and the US is just kind of no longer a priority for the US. So instead we have to kind of look elsewhere as for kind of trade opportunities. And the government has kind of pivoted towards this Indo-Pacific tilt strategy, which is looking at the very fast-growing Indo-Pacific region, in particular through delivering accession to the CPTPP agreement. So that's an agreement of kind of 11 countries in the region, including Singapore, Australia, Japan, and as well as a new bilateral trade deal with India, which was launched this year. So looking at those deals in a little bit of detail, in terms of the kind of size of those deals, when we look at the percentage of UK trade that's covered by them, you see that CPTPP is much larger, covering kind of 7 to 8% of UK trade, compared to India, which is covering sort of, you know, 1 to 2% of our trade. So it looks like CPTPP is the much bigger deal. But once we remove all the countries within CPTPP, where we already have a trade agreement, so that obviously includes Australia as of very recently, but also countries like Canada and Japan, where we have quite recent new trade agreements with those countries, you see that CPTPP becomes much, much smaller as a share of UK trade, and India, as in comparison, kind of looks a lot bigger. There will be some scope for kind of marginal liberalisation through CPTPP, particularly on the older agreements. So agreements, for example, with Mexico, which is a CPTPP member. But overall, it's kind of expected to be quite small. The other thing to say is, although we're saying that the Indo-Pacific region is kind of a fast-growing region, and that's the reason that the government might want to kind of target it, in terms of import growth, CPTPP on average is not going to be where that kind of centre of fast growth is. The average growth rate will actually be below kind of the global average, which is obviously not true for India. So overall, this kind of suggests that we might want to kind of focus on India and the potential impacts that you might get there, and that will kind of be the bulk of where the value is coming from this economic strategy. The first thing you want to look at is, well, okay, well, what do current trade flows suggest about, you know, what will the impacts of this deal be? So first of all, just look at kind of the revealed comparative advantage, and that's basically a measure of a country's export specialism. So it's kind of share of exports in sectors compared to the sort of world share in those sectors. And this compares kind of US and Indian specialisms to kind of show us, well, where is India sort of relatively more competitive and relatively less competitive, to see where, you know, you might face kind of more intense import competition and where opportunities might be for UK exporters. And what we see here is, you know, this deal with India, they're not highly competitive in kind of manufacturing sectors. So there's this kind of potential for UK manufacturers to kind of sell their goods to India. But on the other hand, they do have quite high export specialism in a number of kind of textile sectors. And so what we'll see is that increased competition from Indian exporters in these sectors in the UK. And all of this kind of aligns with the government's own analysis of the Indian deal. So it suggests that, you know, big potential gains for exporters, but particularly manufacturing exporters, some competition in kind of textile sectors, and that results in some output and employment kind of falls in textile sectors in the UK. So ultimately, this deal is essentially a kind of, well, sell manufacturing and kind of buy textiles deal when you look at the kind of current trade flows. So that's kind of clear that there's these big kind of gains for exporters. But what about our importers, which are also very important in a trade deal, but often somewhat neglected? Well, this measure just looks at kind of trade complementarity. And trade complementarity is essentially asking how similar, you know, two countries' kind of trade profiles are. So are the goods and services that India is producing and exporting sort of closely aligned to the goods and services that the UK wants to import and to consume? And what we see here is that the EU, where the UK has been very closely integrated and very closely integrated in supply chains with, has a very high measure of complementarity, as you'd expect. And the US is a fairly close substitute, but India is, you know, it's quite below in terms of kind of substitutability. And what this means for UK firms is that if they are looking to kind of replace EU firms in supply chains or look for kind of new suppliers of consumer goods, India might be slightly less well matched for that purpose. So that's kind of looking at the current trade flows, but we've basically said this is all about, you know, pursuing growth. And when you're pursuing growth, you need to be thinking a bit more long term. And so what we need to also look at as well, what are the kind of longer term, more dynamic implications of this kind of growth targeting strategy? So the first thing to say is there is you know, that big kind of export potential could kind of even grow as the Indian import market grows. So India is expected to be one of the fastest kind of, or among the fastest growing import markets. It's going to represent 7% of global import growth or it's expected to represent 7% of global import growth to 2050, an increase from what is currently the eighth largest import market to the third largest import market by 2050, so just below India, just below China and the US in terms of import size. And what this means is that, you know, the gains that you get from an FTA now will increase, you know, so between 2030 and 2050, you see that kind of potential gains almost trebling for India, whereas for the US, which kind of has a slower growing import market, they're only kind of doubling over the same period, because we do see this just a big expansion of import demand. This does assume you can kind of maintain that market share, you know, over several decades, but the point is that growth potential is there with this deal. The second area, when you look at the sort of more dynamic impacts, is the kind of story on services. So India and the UK are both really big kind of service providers, big services economies, big service exporters. India really stands out amongst its peers for this, as a kind of lower middle income country. And in services, India also has a very big but fast growing import demand for business services in particular. So the demand for import services, for business services, is expected to treble by 2030, and this clearly kind of presents it as a big opportunity for the UK, given that we are this kind of highly specialised economy in services like business services. But what we do see is that UK firms are currently underperforming in India. So this chart shows the share of a number of countries in the kind of regions and total business services imports which come from the UK. So in the case of India, we get about they get 1.8% of their imports from the UK. When you compare that with countries like Malaysia and Singapore, which are around more like 4% of their imports are coming from the UK. So what this suggests is, you know, to really benefit from this FTA, there is this potential for business services, but we need to kind of use the FTA to unlock some of this underperformance in the sector. We've said India is going to be quite fast growing, and with fast growth also comes more industrial change. So what will be happening is, as the Indian economy kind of develops, the export specialisms are also changing. So this chart is showing the change in revealed comparative advantage, so in export specialisms, over the last 10 years. If you, as a country, your export specialisms are not changing at all, then your sort of dots will be perfectly along that sort of 45 degree line. And the greater the dispersion from that line, the more your export specialisms are changing over the last 10 years. And what you can see in this graph is that the red dots representing India are much more dispersed from that line, which suggests that the kind of level of change of export specialisms in India is higher than it is for the comparator, the US here. Just to break that down a little bit, if you're above that line, it means you have a decreasing RCA, and you can kind of see, if you're in that kind of top left quadrant, that means you previously had an RCA in something, you specialised in something, and you kind of no longer are. And in reverse, if you're kind of below the line, that means you have an increasing RCA, and in that bottom right quadrant, you have an emerging revealed comparative advantage. You weren't previously specialised in these sectors or products, but you now are. And comparing the India and the US, we see India has about 8 kind of sectors or products that are falling into that category, so have emerging revealed comparative advantages, whereas the US only has 1. In the context of a deal with India, what that will do is increase the exposure of UK firms to any uncertainty in India's kind of future trade flows. So, you know, we'll be increasing exposure to Indian trade, and this shows that Indian trade is likely to kind of continue changing. So they will have a more uncertain kind of future profile of competition from India than they would if it was a deal with the US. Uh, The final thing that we look at is the regional impacts that could kind of result as from an Indian free trade agreement. So this compares the impacts from the labour shares in regions for kind of all industries with the share of employment that are in sectors or in regions based on the kind of sectors that India has a higher positive revealed comparative advantage. So basically in the sectors where we expect kind of more intense import competition from India and the US as a comparator. And ultimately the kind of key takeaway from this slide is that kind of big impact on London. And that is ultimately coming from this kind of business services story, but the kind of reverse side of it. So India is a highly specialised in business services, even more so than the UK in some kind of subsectors of business services. And so the kind of regional impact could be quite concentrated in London if you do kind of have this competition coming from India. Sorry, the slight misordering, but so what does that kind of tell us? Well, this kind of brings us to this story about whether we could see what we're calling a kind of services China shock. So what happened with the China shock was that industrialized countries, particularly the US, faced this kind of big increase in imports from China in manufacturing and kind of the lower labor costs in China basically outcompeted the manufacturing sectors in those countries. And this resulted in kind of big loss of manufacturing jobs, which are kind of fairly good quality jobs in the country. And this is the sort of the typical China shock impact. And what we say is that, you know, if India can kind of maintain this kind of fast rate of growth and can kind of continue exporting, but given the kind of pattern of its current specialisms, this could be more likely to be kind of taking place in services. And for the UK, that's particularly important because we are this kind of very big services orientated economy. And that sort of intense competition and that kind of threat of being undercut with sort of lower cost labour could be quite substantial for UK firms and for the UK. But it doesn't have to kind of be a negative story. So when you look at the Germans' experience of the kind of China expansion of manufacturing, what happened is they were able to kind of specialise and export their higher value added manufacturing successfully into China and sort of benefit from that kind of import demand growth while at the same time benefiting from kind of lower cost manufacturing. So this is the strategy that for the UK to kind of make a success of this, it needs to be able to emulate. So it needs to be able to adapt to competition from India if it does take place, for example, in business services, really kind of specialise in that high value added activity and use the FTA to ensure that it can kind of access and export business services to the Indian market as a result of this kind of trade strategy, at the same time kind of benefiting from any kind of lower cost any lower cost activity as well, to improve broader competitiveness of UK sectors. So in summary, what does this kind of tell us? So the pivot, as we said, you know, the UK generally, as a result of leaving the EU, will be becoming less open as an economy. And this pivot is about, you know, well, in what direction should we kind of reorientate our trade? The Indo-Pacific tilt is the strategy. It's kind of targeting that growth. But we argue that India is really going to be the kind of bulk of that strategy in terms of the benefits. When you look at the short term, what is this deal, you know, based on current flows, what is this trade deal really about? It's that kind of, you know, it does have big opportunities for UK exporters. It's kind of sell manufacturing, buy textiles, you know, some negative impacts, but generally quite an attractive profile of impacts. In the longer run, when you look at this, some of the more kind of dynamic impacts and the growth in India, the export potential is still pretty big and there's still a lot of opportunities. But there's also a less predictable kind of future competition coming in from India. So this does have more risks for UK firms competing with India and kind of having that extra exposure to Indian trade. The strategy, so ultimately to make a success of this, we've said we need to kind of be able to emulate that Germany experience, and that means delivering an FTA that will allow high value-added exports of business services to access that India market, correct that underperformance, and access that kind of growing import market, while at the same time kind of benefiting from the imports that will come in from India. And so that just kind of sets up what we set out in the paper, and then the big question that kind of leaves is, well, will this happen? Which we will talk about a bit more over the course of this panel.
Great, thank you very much, Sophie. Yeah, that's great. It's a big deal, but with big uncertainty in the medium term, and big uncertainty in whether it actually happens or not. Right, John, what's going on?
Well, thanks, Torsten. And first, congratulations to Sophie and her colleagues for producing this report, which I'm sure will give my former colleagues lots to think about. And I think also a really exciting project as part of the Economy 2030, which I think is really good. So what I'd like to do is just say a little bit about the pivot overall and put India in the context of that. Overall, this part of the world is growing very fast, not just India, but also other parts of Asia Pacific. And so it does make sense for the UK to be focusing on that, not to the exclusion of the US. You know, we're always ready when they come back to the table. As you say, it's a big priority for the government. So I just wanted to talk about the opportunities and some of the challenges. I think the key opportunity in the region as a whole is that not only is growth happening, but the middle class is becoming much more numerous, and about 80% of the growth in the middle class is up till 2030 is going to be in this region. And by the way, most of that's in China. So I'll say a little bit about China. That is important for the UK because the sorts of products and services that the UK makes are going to be particularly attractive to people as they become richer. So I think that's one of the main drivers for this. As you say, free trade agreements will provide greater access to those markets. And that's both CPTPP and an Indian FTA, and indeed any other agreements that we want to make. But also, we'll need to be working on wider market access. So we're not going to have a deal with China, comprehensive FTA. I can predict that.
That's very bold of you, John.
But we still chip away at market opening in places like that, which is really important. On CPTPP, which you said was a bit incremental, I mean, I'd say two things that are a bit more positive about it. First is that it helps set the rules for trade amongst a sort of fairly like-minded set of countries, and that's important more widely in trade policy, particularly when the WTO is a bit stuck, and will help us elsewhere. So I think that is important. And secondly, there is a queue of countries wanting to join. Indeed, China has said it wants to join, as has Taiwan, which is a bit of a challenge. But also South Korea, Thailand's pretty keen to join. And so the benefits to the UK as those countries join could be much more significant. So I think we need to bear those two in mind. On India, again, there's a significant increase in the middle class, as you were implying. And there are high barriers, both on goods and services. So there is certainly a prize to go for, and I'll come back to that. So overall, I think all the studies show, and I don't think anything you've said disagrees with this, that there's potential for, you know, significant increases to UK GDP over the medium term. What are the challenges? As I said, China is the biggest part of the Indo-Pacific. And so the UK has got to make a success of the old strategy, hit the sweet spot with China where it can continue to benefit from trade with China, whilst, of course, having concerns about politics and human rights there. So I think that will be a really big sort of future challenge for the policy. Secondly, what you were talking about depends on doing the deal with India, and that is going to be, I think, more challenging than any of the FTAs that the UK has so far secured. And if there is a deal, it's got to be a reasonably deep deal, because otherwise the benefits and the risks will not be particularly high. And that is a challenge, because India pulled out of the big regional trade agreement, RCEP, that's just been launched, and hasn't really done any bilateral deals for quite some time. So that's a challenge. And I think thirdly, there will be fierce competition for these markets, precisely because they are so attractive. And as you rightly say, the UK is not as embedded there as many of the existing players. I mean, Japan, China, these are the big players in that part of the world. Finally, just a few words on impact on the UK economy. So, definitely positive overall. Most trade liberalising measures are positive. You talked about the impact on services potentially. I mean, I think the UK is in a relatively good position because it is an open economy. When you measure the restrictiveness of our barriers to trade, they are much less than the OECD average. So we're already used to competition. In fact, we've got huge numbers of imports from India on services already. And similarly, our tariff levels, apart from the odd area like agriculture, are pretty low. So I think the UK has gone through a lot of the cycles that you were talking about in relation to the US. So I'm not too worried about that. But certainly the government needs to be talking to business about precisely in different sectors, what are the opportunities and how can we make the most of it. Thank you.
Very good. Very perky, John. It's nice to be get us going in the morning with some general good news. We're going to come back to China, which is slightly the elephant in the... there's a reason why it's called the Indo-Pacific tilt there, without mentioning the big thing in the... rather in between. Anyway, right, Anna.
Yeah, so let's start with the sort of the chances of getting a deal, which John nodded towards. So, of course, lots of people are coming to these negotiations fairly bruised by losing the bilateral investment treaty, which the UK did have with India. There are lots of challenges, I would say, obviously the trade business side being one of them, those negotiations, but we need to think about the political risks at the moment. Now, when you read speeches about trade with India, you'll hear huge emphasis on the point of its democratic values being one of the biggest democracies in the world. What we have seen in recent years with things like the farmers' protests, etc., is that this is actually quite a fraught political situation in India. And if there's one thing that businesses don't love, it's lots of political risk. And on top of that, when you talk to investors and people that are interested in doing trade with India, a lot of the areas that they're most interested in are things like, how do they form a cog within the system that are things like digital ID, that are things like telecoms, that are things that will really tap into the fact that you have a young population who are going to acquire the need for certain services. So you want to have a little niche within those particular areas. But that's very challenging if you have a regime that might become in certain aspects a bit unpalatable for some firms. So things like digital ID are incredibly sensitive for that sort of thing. And we are dealing with those regulatory challenges in the UK. So what you can have is no regulatory solution in your domestic market and then facing very fraught fraught regulatory scene in your exporting market. And those two things aren't very comfortable. So those are some of the initial challenges and opportunities. But I think when we talk about trade deals and we talk about GDP benefits, everyone gets very upset if we put too much emphasis in the media on how small the GDP benefits might be, because they have to, at the moment, use things like static modelling. So it's very hard to anticipate future demand. So it is challenging. You're not always comparing apples with apples when you compare the future opportunities versus the cost of barriers with the EU. But what is important, and we don't talk about enough, is what are going to be the utilisation rates and why of any deal we have, how are we going to use this deal in the future, and when we talk about the potential shock that we that was avoided with Germany but felt elsewhere, the key difference there was a very aggressive skills agenda. So unless we see an investment in education in the UK that is being made bespoke to the opportunities we perceive within the Indo-Pacific, those gaps that we're supposed to fill, then we are not going to see this huge win. We're not going to see trade equals jobs, which is, a very favoured mantra for obvious reasons, because, I don't think anyone goes into working in trade policy or politics without wanting to make people more prosperous. But we've got to make good on those opportunities. And to do that, we really do have to specialise, particularly in vocational education, to meet the business's needs. And then I think just very, very quickly, before I wind up and we get into the broader conversation, we hear from Sally, I think something that would help us a lot is to see this deal from the Indian perspective. And one thing that I always try and do religiously is read the Indian press when they're writing about the UK. And it was very interesting seeing the charts we had in terms of what India sees as some of the opportunities. And some of that is extremely specialised manufacturing. So things like instruments used in healthcare settings and the like, but also labour mobility. And we know that, you know, everyone always says India visas, India visas. Well, it's a bit more complicated than just visas, and we always have to call it labour mobility, not immigration, don't we, John, when it comes to government talking about trade. So let's call it labour mobility. That's great. Now, we need to import young people to work in the UK as our population ages, and we need to be able to essentially export cash to get a return on investments to, for our pensions to actually function. So we need those two things flowing in either direction. And what we saw is a lovely services chart illustrating the gravity that still dominates the services market. So we need to be able to make ourselves hypermobile. And that means dealing with things like barriers that aren't just the visas themselves or the numbers of people that can come here, but also the ease of that travel. So sheer cost of travel, one side of it, but also things like the NHS surcharge, other issues to do with social security. And if you read the Indian media, they are very concerned about making it cheap and fair for people to come and work here. So we need to find those ways to get labour flowing in one way and exports and cash flowing in the other direction if it's going to really pay off.
Just on that's great, the nudge on fair mobility. What do you think that, as the woman that's been reading the Indian press, what is fair? And just tell us whether you think the Indian press is giving more attention to the trade deal or to our Partygate story. As an avid reader of it, it sounds like.
Well, I mean, a lot of the Indian press, you know, do enjoy the slightly the eccentricities of the British political scene. It's fair to say.
That's an excellent euphemism.
They are particularly concerned with what they regard as something that's close to double taxation, but on the individual, which is how plenty of people regard the UK's current approach with issues like the NHS surcharge, particularly because of the nature of the jobs undertaken so far by people from India.
I.e.
so,
the NHS.
Yes, working within the NHS and therefore feeling okay, that they're already making their contribution.
Thank you very much indeed. Right. Sally, are businesses going to do anything? Do they want this? And are they actually going to do anything with this trade deal if they get it?
Do you know, it's fascinating because I'm a trade nerd. I get excited by every single one of the announcements.
You can get help for that.
I'm quite happy in my little geeky world. Getting my clients interested can be harder. And John, don't take offence, but they weren't that excited about Australia and New Zealand unless they were in the wine and spirits industry. Every single one of my clients wants to talk about India. Every single one. This is the deal, potential deal, that is really getting people exercised. Why is that? We've touched on a couple of the aspects. One is the fact it is a population of 1.4 billion people, a middle class of 100 million at the minute, plus not only is the middle class growing, but the definition of middle class in India is earning between $10 and $20 per day. So there's a scope up in terms of earning potential as well as in sheer numbers. But probably the thing that most interests the companies that I speak to is India's education system, which Anna has touched on. It's the third biggest higher education system in the world. It churns out more graduates than everybody other than US and China. The skills on which it focuses are very heavily around STEM. It's engineering, it's tech, it's data, it's all the things that we are most desperately in need of in this country. And whereas Anna rightly says our education system hasn't come close to meeting the gap between supply and demand. So a big part of the interest for a lot of the companies I speak to is, well, what can we start doing in India that we're struggling to do here because we can't get the resources? The question then is, well, what unlocks through a trade deal that they can't currently be doing? So what's stopping companies doing investment into India right now? And I think it comes into five buckets. And again, Anna has mentioned a couple of them. I won't mention them again, but geopolitics and mobility are two of those. The other three buckets that I wanted to just touch on are firstly, people like to do business with people that they know. And they like to do business where they know how business is done. And there is a little bit of a cultural gap between the UK and India that doesn't exist between the UK and the US to anything like the same extent, or the UK and the EU to anything like the same extent, or even the UK and Australia and New Zealand to anything like the same extent. And there is a nervousness about, can I form the relationship of trust that I need to have in place in order to make my investment? And it's harder when there's a language barrier, where there's a cultural gap, and that needs to be, finding a way to match that is going to be quite important. That's the part that a trade deal will really struggle to unlock, but where John's former colleagues at DIT working on the export strategy and similar will find other ways to chip away at that. The last two, I think, are much more interesting in terms of a free trade deal. And they're around how to make the first investment into a country. Can you do a relatively risk-free toe dip into the water? And with India, it's really difficult because the investment protection has gone. Establishment requires all kinds of local restrictions. Quite often when you come to a state as opposed to a federal level, you find that you need to be buying locally as part of sort of local requirements. The grants and incentives that you would otherwise be looking for aren't available. It's quite expensive to dip your first toe into the Indian water as opposed to other countries, and that's a real hindrance. And hopefully a trade deal will go some way to matching or unlocking, unpicking some of that. The fourth one of my five, mobility being the fifth, is intellectual property. Now, historically, the US, the EU, the UK have been IP, intellectual property creators. We have very stringent intellectual property protection regimes. Equally, historically, the Indo-Pacific region, and I'm not just talking about India here, I mean collectively, have been IP takers. We've invested factories and similar. There have been examples of where that intellectual property has not been protected in a way that British companies might like. And because
that's
of that...
That's very politely put. I'm going no further than that
in terms of what I'm saying, but yep. There is a fairly interesting dynamic shift that we're seeing. China is one example where the intellectual property protections, their regimes are becoming much more stringent as they themselves are starting to create IP that they themselves want to protect. And I think a solid intellectual property provision, a sensible innovation chapter, will go a long way in this deal to putting minds at risk. A couple of other points then on why a free trade agreement. The first is, and this is kind of where it sounds like I'm disagreeing with you and I'm not, but one of the things that the free trade agreement will do is lock in certainty. And I know you said this is going to create more uncertainty because India is a very rapidly evolving economy. Business can cope with that because the timescale of that change is manageable. But locking in certainty of positions now, that really matters to business. A solid digital chapter will go an enormously long way to helping businesses feel comfortable. Anna touched on that. The investment chapter is going to be fascinating. I think that's where quite a lot of the crunch is going to come. Where are the risks then for British businesses? I see it in a handful of places. I think the state versus federal point is going to be a real sticking point here. Probably the thing that could unlock more investment by British businesses into India than anything else, forget free trade agreement, would be if India sorted out its single market. And that would be a massive win.
I don't think that's going to be in the deal, Sally.
I don't think it is, but that would make a massive difference. The second is that, and this is again no criticism of any economist, especially when I'm sitting next to two of them, three of them, a number of economists. But when we talk about goods, we talk about a great deal of granularity about the different sectors. We distinguish between different forms of manufacturing. Yeah. But people then talk about services as an amorphous lump, and there is even business services. The ONS definition covers everything from cleaning and waste services on one end of the skills base, up to the pinnacle of services skills, auditors. Stop it, John. And because there's such that enormous range, even within that sector, you don't get the granularity of focus in the economic statistics that really allow you to tell the full story. And I think that actually there's an enormously positive story to tell, where we can really focus in on what we do best, financial services, fintech, law tech, trade tech, the regulated professional services, all of those I think can be massively improved and increased in terms of exports to India, and in return we'll import slightly lower skilled services that actually we've got a skills gap and we really, really need. So I see that as a net win. Final point, where can the UK most make a strategic advantage from a business perspective? If we can position ourselves, much as we did with Japan in the 80s, as the gateway into Europe for Indian firms and the gateway into India for European firms, because we've got decent trade deals with both, I think that could put us in the sort of thin part of the seesaw, that could put us in a really, really valuable place.
Very good.
Wonderful. That's
Thank
where we
need
to
be. The visual representation of the pivot.
At the end there, that was like you wouldn't have known what it was without a mime.
Sorry. What it was. Anyway, give Sally a cup. That's great. Right. Okay. You've all been, with the exception of Anna, who's a little bit less perky. But anyway, people are like, generally, not in life, Anna, just specifically on this deal. But like, generally, you've all been suspiciously perky. So I think we need to dig into that a bit. Just to remind everyone on Slido, put your question in under hashtag trade pivot. There's a lot of questions in at the moment. Actually, a lot of them actually focusing on issues we haven't touched on. So we should make sure we do justice to those as we go through, particularly on some of it on how we think about the impact on different parts of the UK, and actually quite a lot asking about what the impact is inside India itself. Some people on the questions are less selfish about the UK's interests than this disgraceful panel have been so far. So let's first of all just touch on the big picture of this pivot. I thought we should cover the big picture of the pivot, like what we're actually trying to achieve here. Then the like detail of what's actually in this thing, what might be in this thing, and we should probably therefore clarify some of the things we're talking about here, like investment, security, and the rest that we're touching on. Then let's try to come back up to like the big picture. How does this fit in with what the UK is actually trying to do as an economic strategy, where it's not absolutely always clear that the trade strategy is 100% match. Obviously, it was when you were there, John, but 100% match with what we're saying industrial strategy-wise. And Anna's given us a nudge, which is obviously success looks like an overall strategy that includes skills and the rest. And then we're going to finish on, is any of this going to happen? Or did everyone just waste an hour of their lives talking about a deal? That's never going to happen, and off we go. We're doing that at the end, so you don't all switch off before we get there. Right, so first of all, John, on this, so as you know, the man that was around when we were coming up with the pivot once, Biden had told us to kind of go away and we'll see you in a few years, nicely. The China issue. So like one thing is, so generally everyone post-Brexit, we're in a weird world where people are saying, this is part of a protectionist turn. There's like Brexit here, there's China protectionism in the US. But actually like the political economy of it in the UK has been much more great, exciting, let's go and do lots of other trade deals, which in the end is kind of a compensating for a closing of our level of openness in aggregate, but within a change within the levels overall. So first of all, it is a bit weird, isn't it, that we're all really keen on lots of openness having kind of done this thing. And then secondly, we're going to come on to China and where that sits in the Indo-Pacific, given that it's got all the people, which doesn't get to appear in the title of the region that everyone wants to talk about. So go on. First of all, general, like the idea of pivoting, having chosen to be a less open economy, now desperate to be as open as we can with anyone else that will sit down at a table with us, what's going on?
Well, a lot of politics is going on, obviously, we won't rerun the whole Brexit.
No, let's definitely not do that. But just the general idea that we're desperate to do deals with anyone we can get to sit down with us. I'm being slightly pejorative, but like broadly, we really like, and that as a political economy choice is a distinct one. The government and all parties to a degree want that.
Yeah, well, I think the UK, has always been a pretty open trading nation. Different constellations come and go, but I think that continues, as you say, to be a pretty shared view across the political spectrum, probably not by everybody. So this is a consequence of having a set of responsibilities or powers that we didn't have before that we can now look at. Where are the places that we can explore trade deals that we couldn't before? And obviously, I mean, we did start with the US, although we are able to walk and chew gum at the same time.
I've heard rumours.
CPTPP preparations started quite a long time ago as well. So there's always...
It's a rhetorical shift more, that's what's happened recently.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the sort of... two scenarios. There are big countries where we have lots of trade, where even a small opening will give us a lot. And then there are other countries where we have less trade, but which are growing fast, and therefore, so we should. But this and Indo-Pacific, as you well know, it's not just a trade thing; it's also a security thing. There's a whole lot of things around it. I mean, on China.
Let's go on to China. It's kind of a bit awkward.
I mean, again, you know, I've lived through a lot of fluctuations in our
position. George Osborne wouldn't be doing exactly the same thing that we're doing today.
I did go with David Cameron to China on one occasion.
Was that when we were calling it the golden age of
golden
era. What era are we on now? Bronze or something? Or sub-bronze?
Not golden, I suspect. But... I mean, you know, I don't speak for the government anymore, but the government position is we do need to have a strong trading and investment relationship with China. There are just certain areas that we are not happy for them to invest in, or where we have concerns about aspects of trade. You know, if you look at all the economic and population data, if we're not active in trading with China, then this is not going to work.
It's not going to work. Very good. That's a good clear. Sally, when let's just do China, and then we're going to come back on to spend most of the session on India and CPTPP in general. But on China, when your clients are saying to you, do want to talk about India?
Yep.
Do they want to talk about China? I mean, there's no prospect of an FTA with China in the short term, but do they want to talk about China as well? Where do they sit in their relative?
They do. They do want to speak about China as well. There is probably more suspicion of the difficulty of doing business in China than there is of India. Okay. So where people have already put this now famous toe into the water and have started doing some form of economic activity in China, sometimes it's gone well, sometimes it hasn't. It's often much harder to withdraw operations from China if things haven't gone as planned. And the things that typically go off track are quite a lot harder to predict in China than India. All of which collectively means that they get, for exactly the same reasons as with India, people see opportunity, but they see the challenges as being exponentially greater as well, and therefore they would rather be looking at other markets for the time being.
Okay, we're taking you as the voice of business for today. So does that mean you think, does the British business looking at a government saying this country needs an Indo-Pacific strategy and we're going to prosecute that by focusing on India and CPTPP is basically the right approach, rather than saying, guys, have you seen how many people live in China?
Yes, I think it is the right approach for now. I think, again, interestingly, just coming back to the US point, not one of my clients was clamouring for a US trade deal. Not one. Because they could already pretty much do what they want to do with the US, and they couldn't see any obvious and immediate benefit from it. And they were quite disappointed that so much of the government's focus was on the US for as long as it was. And they are much more excited at the idea of unlocking Asian opportunities.
Okay. Anna, what do you reckon on the... So this is your last word on China. So on this, like, it is a bit weird, isn't it? We want an Indo-Pacific tilt. In the trade space, that's this. In the security space, as you rightly mentioned, I mean, we can dress it up however we like, but it basically is an anti-China strategy. So what's going on? How are we going to reconcile these things?
Rule number one as a government, Western government, having a China strategy is you don't mention China.
Excellent. Good.
Right? That's the
is
test.
That your cunning plan?
If they mention sort of forces within the Asian region and avoid, you know, so you never get very far control-effing China on a government document when you're trying to work out what the actual strategy towards it is.
Okay.
It is a way of avoiding it. I think what is interesting in terms of the wider CPTPP dynamic and who might be sort of showing us a lot of goodwill at the moment, because a lot of this is about goodwill at an intergovernmental level at the end of the day, that's what gets deals done. I'm not sure we would have had an Australia deal as quickly as we'd had there not been the sort of the changing of the tides in terms of how people have approached China. I'm not sure we'd be looking at CPTPP with the same confidence were it not for the fact that Japan is feeling pretty positive about the UK being more invested literally and figuratively and in every sense within the region.
Okay.
And I think given the situation in places like Kashmir, India's decision-making about whether or not it wants to be a closer okay. partner with the UK is also informed by that.
So basically you're saying that the nature of the Indo-Pacific tilt, i.e. tilting towards that without making much progress in China, is actually contingent on the security side and the wider attitude.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when we hear about quads and troikas and everything else, you know, we have to remember that that's the backdrop, that's the reality.
But that is in direct tension to John's, in the long run, the economic strategy of accessing the wider Asian market is China in terms of scale.
I'm not sure that is partly because of the population dynamics for China. They are shifting dramatically very quickly. Yep. But also when you have seen, and you know, I have the luxury of being able to sort of single out particular businesses, right? A really good example of what put businesses off doing business in China is what they saw happen to Nokia and the bifurcation that's had to take place, because what happened is you had to cut your business in
Remind
two.
Everyone, not everyone would have spent their whole life.
Yeah, sorry. No, like, yeah, not obsessed with telecoms in Asia. So
I mean, many of us are. Give us your quick
thoughts. We heard, as ever, we heard a lot about Huawei and whether or not it was going to be integrated into networks in the UK, and that became a huge point of tension. And we all remember things, you know, for instance, things leaking from National Security Council and things like that too, that brought up points around whether or not Huawei should be integrated here. While that was happening, of course, China was very unhappy about in their view, what was singling out one of their, you know, key companies. And that created a lot of tension for people operating in the telecom space who were associated with Western governments in China. And that caused very rapidly a very hostile environment for some of them operating there. And because of the level of state control in China, the rapidity of that, if the mood shifts, it is dramatic, it is instant, it is very difficult to even get things like your people out of the country. It's difficult to get your money out of the country because the level of state control is so absolute. And Nokia very much felt the rough end of that.
Right, okay. We don't want to be Nokia. That's also true over the last 20 years in terms of...
Other companies
were available as examples. Right, good.
Many other companies were affected.
Right, we're now going to pretend China doesn't exist for the rest of this conversation, which is basically what the UK's economic strategy is also going to do. So that is fine. Right, now, on the detail of what this thing is actually about. So let's take some of the questions in this space. And Sophie, there's a few following up on points you've raised. So let's do this in the like short-term impact, medium-term hopeful impact, if it all goes to plan. So Sophie, Tom is raising this question here, which is, there you go. So what are the relative sizes of the sectors that will benefit in the short term versus textiles, where we're saying us, plus actually the government themselves say, our domestic producers will lose out. Let's touch on the regional impact, and also let's touch on the gender impact of who works in these different sectors in the UK, which is obviously the traditional focus. And then related to that, if I can find the right, someone just wants a clarification on your regional impact chart, but I can't find their question because I still can't work out. Here we go. Which I think is just to clarify who was benefiting and who was losing in the chart, because it was a positive and a negative and life's complicated in charts when we're going quickly. So let's cover those two things. So first of all, which kind of manufacturing is a benefit? How big are they relative to textiles? Who works in textiles? Where are these textiles?
Yeah, so the kind of advanced manufacturing sectors that are set to gain, so it includes kind of car manufacturing. That's a big industry. Manufacturing is quite small in the UK compared to our services sectors.
Yeah.
But for within manufacturing, you know, these are some of the much bigger sectors. So textiles is quite small. It's already quite import intensive. We already import a lot of the textiles that we consume. I think it's kind of less. Depending on your kind of measures of it, but it's probably less than 100,000 jobs in the UK. As you kind of allude to, what's interesting about the textiles sector is it is one of the few sort of manufacturing sectors that is female dominated.
The only one, isn't it?
I think it probably is. I mean, depending on what kind of classification you look at. But yeah, it's a relatively low earning manufacturing sector, and it's a female dominated one. And that is rare within kind of manufacturing. So you do have a kind of difference between those two kind of markets that you're benefiting and the ones that can see kind of some of the negative consequences from enhanced import competition. Regionally, they're both kind of outside of London. You know, the Midlands obviously big for kind of advanced car manufacturing and other manufacturing sectors. Textiles a bit more kind of spread, but again, this isn't the London story. So what this question I think is asking more about is where we see those kind of where we say there's this kind of risk to London and the South East, that's based on big competition in business services. And business services are very, very kind of strongly London orientated, as we know. So, as you know, as we kind of alluded to, there's opportunities for business services and there's potential costs. So that chart was quite one-sided in a sense. It was just looking at where the adjustment costs might fall. Yeah. It's not looking at, you know, where the benefits could fall at the same time. So all we're saying is, you know, as someone who's working, you know, where might you be more concerned about the FTA kind of that's coming? But the benefits will be quite widely spread across, you know, a big range of industries, a big range of regions, and that kind of aligns again. If you look at the government's analysis of the India FTA, it has kind of positive impacts across the regions, which kind of was what was being asked for in that question. But it does have a kind of lower positive impact in London, and that again is coming from this employment sort of being reallocated from those kind of service sectors into this expanding manufacturing sector. Generously, that's just reallocation because those sectors are growing fastest. Sort of less generously, that's import competition in business services that's kind of kicking those people out of the jobs that they're doing. But as Sally says, at the kind of lower end, kind of lower value added business service end.
Okay, very good. Now, Sally, on kind of what's actually in this deal, okay. Who knows to some degree? But in terms of what actually matters, so can we, I don't want total brilliance, but like, so this discussion compared to most public discussions of trade policy, obviously, as usual, is less focused on, you know, people thinking in terms of tariffs, basically, because it's the vaguely understandable bit of trade policy. And it can be important, particularly in the Indian case, because there are some. But you're more focused on some of the wider questions, like on investment certainty. So give us a bit of the recent history on the removal of some of that certainty, and then who it matters to. And is that because that's the kind of businesses you particularly talk to, or do you think businesses in general, that's what they're focused on?
Crikey. Okay, so let's start to break it down a little bit. As a general observation, companies don't want to talk about what the architecture of a free trade agreement looks like, or what matters, or which chapters they should be reading. They would much rather pay me to do that for them, which suits me down to the ground, and I'm fine with that. So the conversation is much more around what's causing me problems now, and will this free trade agreement unlock those?
Okay. So
the things that that I will be looking out for on behalf of people who have an interest, mm-hmm, are the investment chapter, which is all around what restrictions might there be on my ability to establish an office or some form of presence. The mobility chapters, not immigration chapters, mobility chapters. There is so much that can be done to ease mobility around that. And it, as Anna rightly says, it's not just visas, it's around the entire environment, how long people can be in a particular location, what they can be doing, what restrictions they might be placed. At the minute, a lawyer who goes on holiday to India will almost certainly have his or her phone confiscated by his or her firm before leaving, because India is so restrictive on legal services that even receiving an email onto your phone can be a breach of your travel restrictions. So that kind of thing would genuinely make a real difference. Digital, mm-hmm, because there's quite a lot of requirement in India to maintain data on local servers, which is really difficult for companies to actually manage in practice. So I'll be looking at that. And then an innovation chapter, looking at around how intellectual property can be managed. Those are cross-sectoral concerns. They matter to manufacturers, they matter to services providers, they matter to even tourists going on a holiday visa. Those are all critical things.
Okay, that's really interesting. And does sound slightly more service-focused in terms of what that's getting at, as opposed to people that have a more literal, I want to sell this thing, basically,
it
right now.
It depends what you want to sell.
It does. So if you're... In fact, lots of goods can bring with them services and all the rest, yeah.
And have, it's, you know, stringent intellectual property that baked into what they're doing, and they need that to be protected. So, I mean, even if you're looking at something like Scottish shortbread, which is kind of almost one of the more simple things that mm-hmm. you can be looking at. There's so much value in the fact that it's from Scotland and perceived as a high value
shortbread
or biscuit. Yeah. The protections around the brand and trade are really important. It's almost
That's
impossible
good.
To unpick it.
I didn't see shortbread coming in today, but I always learn something in these sessions. Right, John, let's take two questions together for you on the short term, and then I want to move to the medium term, which is, so on the actual getting a deal, so we're going to come back to the existential, do we get a deal or not? But, you know, it's a bit like India's talking to us.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a surprise in some ways for many over you look over the 20-year period. Arguably, one of the reasons they're talking to us is because we're just so keen to talk to everybody. It's a bit unfair, but arguably, I'll let you tell us or not otherwise. So what is it, given that we are so keen, is cut slightly how we've got them to the table. What are we going to have to give up, basically, or compromise on to get this deal? And a version, slightly more pejoratively, if I can find it from somebody, is what is the version of chlorinated chicken that we don't yet know about that, in the course of this deal being discussed, is at some point going to be on the table?
Well, it'd be nice not to have a version of chlorinated chicken. But, I mean, I think mobility is... the sort of high profile area that India has always been concerned about and always wanted. I mean, you know, we have had experience of negotiating as an EU member state with India over some years.
How did that go, John? Well,
it hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet, despite those years.
You know, some people say that one of the reasons it hasn't happened is because the UK was so keen to have provisions about mobility.
Yeah.
So those will be important for the Indians, and you know, I'm sure there will be the usual constructive discussions with my former colleagues in the Home Office about that.
Do you think, just on that, so do we think if other bits of government budge, NHS surcharge and the rest, but the Home Office doesn't, because that's what history tells us happens, they're on migration?
Well,
what do we think? Is there still a deal to be done?
I mean, I don't have that insight now. But I think what I would say is that it's clear, and people have said, look, what was important was to get control of our borders. We then decide what we're going to do with it. And this is about people coming for work.
Maybe things have changed. Basically.
We'll see.
Okay. Very good. So, but you don't think there's this particular good? There's not something on the good side, like textiles. In the end, I mean, the government strategy is basically we're fine. We've already got loads of textile import competition. A bit more doesn't hurt. The industry died basically in the end of the 90s and the early 2000s in terms of being a large employer.
You can always, I mean, as we did with agriculture, you can phase things in if you are concerned about the sort of immediate impacts, but I wouldn't have thought so. There will be discussions about standards. I mean, you know, it's a hot political topic, agriculture standards and so forth, but it's not the same sort of salience.
It's not the same salience yet, at least. Right. There's a
Just on the first question about is India really keen on doing a deal with us or not? Well, my opposite number in EY India tells me that he has never experienced the Indian government being as keen as they are right now. Okay. So it feels...
We want to get to a why, but we can't do that till the end, remember, because they're going to switch off if we tell them it's not going to happen. Yes, we want to hear why they're keen. That's very good, because there's some good questions here about, like, is there any evidence that Modi has ever wanted to do anything like this, ever? Mm. So what on earth is going on? Right, okay, let's come back to this last point that you raised on regulatory... So let's move to some of the underpinnings here. So, when we were discussing the US trade deal ad nauseum, regulatory convergence was obviously the issue, similarly with the EU over the longer time period. And there's quite a lot of questions here around, I'll give you an example, but how do we, who will benefit in China? What about in India? Sorry, here's a question bringing up on the screen now. What about ethical considerations about working conditions in China and in India and the rest? Is this all just nonsense? This is a kind of regulatory convergence, free trade agreement.
Having concerns about labour standards.
Yes.
I wouldn't say that's nonsense.
No. The fact that anything's going to happen on it. No. We're pro concerns about workers' rights here.
So So what I would say is that if you want to know if something's likely to happen, you have to consider the domestic political appetite as well. I think there's a degree of domestic appetite in India because it looks around at some of its key trading partners, not just us, places like France that has some similar, although people who are really into it will get annoyed if I call them similar, but things like the Modern Slavery Act that have very, very stringent demands upon businesses that are getting yet more stringent because of situations like forced labour in China. There's domestic appetite here. There's also domestic appetite in India, because you have a lot of state-by-state approach to things like labour standards, particularly things like unionisation. So we have to remember, comparing a state like, say, Kerala, for example, to, say, a northern Indian state, very different. I mean, Kerala's borderline communist is a clumsy term, but has aspects of that, so it's very heavily unionised, right? So, but there is a, there's a domestic Indian appetite to have more homogenised labour standards. And so I think that means that you get the crucial ingredients to, say, it's not so much UK leverage, but it's the right thing to poke at the right point in time. And therefore, you might get a degree of progress. But it's fair to say that there's lots of concerns among civil society groups about what a trade deal could mean in terms of things like combating issues like sweatshops. But it's fair to say that those are having to be dealt with by UK businesses anyway because of the domestic legislation we have around modern slavery, the history of things like Rana Plaza, the huge attention that goes on that now, and the issues around things like fast fashion now.
But do you think that will, so do we think progress will come less because it will be formalised into the FTA and more because these wider trends will basically come, when people want to do business with a particular company, these issues will then be on the table?
I think there is a rare opportunity where both things could be true.
Okay, very good. The okay, well, that's surprisingly perky, isn't it? Right, the, given that you were the less perky one overall, not to be unfair. Right, I want to then touch on this wider strategy question we're going to move up to, and then we're going to come to, is it actually going to happen? So there's a question here which kind of gets at a version of this. So Sophie, why don't you take this first? So, like, one way of thinking about this whole, where is this taking the UK's economic strategy, okay, is John started off by reminding us that if anywhere's middle class is doing well over the in like the 21st century, it's the Asian middle class broadly, and then some, a few countries in Africa, but broadly, it's that's where the scale and the positivity on the growth and the volume is. At one level, so you say, well, that's a big opportunity. A growing middle class is more likely to buy the things that countries like the UK produce, which is used to producing for middle class, middle income markets or higher income markets. The flip side of that is countries that are becoming more middle class are better able to produce those things themselves and are aiming to move into the production of the things that we are, have historically been specialised in, which is one of the reasons why they were a richer country than them in the first place. So it does go both ways, like middle income as consumers, middle income as producers. Is that how can we have the middle income consumers and sell to them without having the middle income producers stealing our breakfast or dinner or whatever you steal?
So I mean, I guess that's where we kind of come to this sort of where do you specialise within these sectors. So what we're seeing is, you know, expanding import demand in some of these service sectors, and that's kind of across all of these kind of growing middle income countries. But at the same time, you know, we don't talk about it as much, but they will be increasing their kind of share of domestic services production and, and kind of becoming more specialised in that. And that's kind of following that typical kind of path of development. You start in your sort of primary services, you specialise as a manufacturer, and then you move into services. India sort of followed a slightly different path, but, you know, to some extent still kind of following the same route. And generally it's just seen that you kind of end up in this in the services place, because that's, you know, where you can get a lot of or that will be where they end up. So that does mean there is this kind of threat of more competition. But what we, when we look at the, you know, the potential for UK services sectors, that ability to kind of specialise in that higher value-added activity, which is just that little bit further out of reach of countries that may not have the same kind of infrastructure and kind of education and kind of high-skilled labour available to them, that's the area where, you know, for the longest, you're not going to be competing, at least directly. And I think that kind of comes back to what Sally was saying, that there's potentially quite high complementarity in that trade in the kind of service sectors. And when we look long-term as well, particularly in the kind of context of the economic strategy, there's lots of reasons to think those jobs might not be very sustainable, even without an Indian FTA. So that kind of lower skilled services work. There's obviously competition, as I said, from a number of other countries that could come in and sort of compete with it. But there's also this sort of technological change driver over the next decade. There's a lot of automation and kind of some of that like white collar work. So with India, the trade relationship used to be a lot of kind of offshoring of, you know, kind of telephone services and stuff. And a lot of that now is automated. You know, you have chatbots that you go on websites instead.
And that is a pleasure for all of us. Thanks for that automation. You've really improved human well-being.
You always have the phone line as well. So, ultimately, using this kind of indirect FTA to support even more specialisation in the kind of high value added services could support an economic strategy that future proofs the sectors.
Anyway. Okay, there you go. Look, there's Sophie's version of what the government's economic strategy could actually be. let's focus on that again. So maybe each of you can take on this. So John, so one way of thinking about this is, don't think about this in terms of the US-China shock and the rest, despite the similarity in terms of a large country with lower labour costs, because the UK isn't a continent. And really, although this FTA is dealing with obviously bilateral trade issues, our objective is to be competitive in high value-added services, selling globally, and this isn't going to affect India's ability to eat our lunch from selling to everybody else. It's about just integrating our supply chains better to allow us both to try to thrive in that global market, so it's all okay. Is that basically what we're trying to do?
Well, I was going to add to what Sophie was saying, that I mean, there will be if this works, there will need to be joint ventures, there will be collaboration. It's not just a sort of production of stuff in the UK and shipping it out. There'll be investment, and I completely agree, by the way, that providing certainty. I mean, when DIT consulted on the India deal, this was one of the big things that came out. So, of course there'll be competition, but on the whole, given that the UK is a pretty open economy already, then enlarging the market in which you can operate is going to be good.
Hmm. Okay. That sounds very perky. Right, I want to bring up a poll on briefly we're going to do this. So it's basically, right, so we've talked here about some of the potential long-term impacts of the trade deal with India, obviously, but this is the main one. So you can think all of these are going to happen, but this is which one do you think is the main impact? So the short-term one, which we see in the government's analysis of the trade deal, which is we get some cheap Indian textiles and we get to sell some other goods. The second one, slightly longer term, positive one, which we've just been talking about, which is basically what Sally's setting out, which is we integrate some supply chains, we can all do better in a bigger global market for services in the years ahead, or the China shock equivalent option, which is basically India changes and grows much faster than we are, I've been expecting. They snaffle our high value-added services lunch, and by giving them access to the British market, we aid that happening. And in 20 years, everyone says that didn't go very well for us. So while people vote on... and I think generally the sense of the panel, I think, is broadly in the second bucket of that. There's a positive outcome. The first is the short-term impact. The second is hopefully the long-term impact. And the third... hopefully won't happen there, and our domestic market's small enough anyway for lots of those high value added services that wouldn't be the main outcome. That's the positive. So let's see if you're all as positive as the panel are. But while people vote on that, I want to give everyone a chance to just touch on this, is any of this going to happen question before we start wrapping up. So there's lots of questions in this space from the audience, so I'm not going to pick one. Oh, here you go. Here's Harry, we'll pick Harry out, I'll lie. Let's see what, so here's Harry's question to you all, which is basically, does India want this? It's not famously either the Indian historical political preference or Modi's kind of narrative about the world. Is that, you know, is this strategy, does our wish for a new strategy fit with other people's wish for their own domestic strategies? And so, Sally, you can go back to your story about your Indian colleague who says, like, everyone is gung-ho for this. Why are they gung-ho?
Honestly, I can't give you an answer. All I can tell you is that there is a perceived change that in attitude from the Indian government. For whatever reason, I think we should be surfing that wave and taking advantage of it.
Okay. Right. John, any idea what's going on?
I mean, I think, as we've been talking about, geopolitics plays a role, and it is an opportunity, and India may think it's easier to negotiate with the UK than it is with the whole of the EU.
Why would they think that, John?
Well, because we're smaller than the whole of the EU.
Oh, right.
but I think, I mean, taking the last comment. Yep. Yeah, it is hard to plan a strategy when you're not in control, and you will never be in control.
Yep.
Completely. And it does depend, as Anna was saying, all these trade agreements depend on political will at home, because there's always a problem with them.
Yeah, because life is complicated, isn't
yeah.
it? They are, right, let's bring up the results of the first poll, and I'm going to go straight to the second one. So just, do you all agree with the panel, or do you all think they're a bunch of optimistic people living in la-la land? What's going to happen? Come on then, let's have the results. We can bring them up. Oh, that's pretty endorsing of you all. If you get 50% of the vote, it's pretty North Korean-esque anyway. I think that's pretty a strong endorsement
that
of your conclusion.
The Resolution Foundation.
That says the Resolution Foundation, yeah, exactly. We didn't fix that, I promise. Right, I'm then going to bring up the last poll, if I can make it work. And then you're all going to answer this question, and then we're going to wrap up and release people to What Did Sue Gray Tell the World Gate, which is going to wipe out everyone's afternoons, because that's how Britain is, you know, running with the 21st century. So, is an FTA ever going to happen? So, the government says it's going to do this within a year. When did the year start?
When they launched it, which was okay. 2 weeks
so
ago.
So we've got
2022 is the five-star year of trade.
Fine, there you go. Right, okay. Is it going to happen in 2022? First option. Second option, it's going to happen, but don't be ridiculous. Nothing ever happens that quickly. India's quite large, quite complicated, and at some point people might wake up to this thing happening and start discussing it. Or is it not going to happen because have you met India over the longer time period? There, I was saying to these guys before we started, my first ever piece of research years ago was on trade negotiations in the WTO, and a lot of it in the end came back to, a lot of everyone else's moaning came back to the fact that the Indians, mainly from developed countries, I have to say, anyway, didn't want to do anything, and so everyone was just wasting their time, which has definitely historically been true to some extent. So come on then, you all vote on that at home, and everyone here on the panel can give us their answer. Anna, what's going to happen?
I think there will be eventually, but probably not quite this year. I think if it is going to happen, it will probably happen relatively fast, though, I think is the case. So it will either happen
early 2023.
Or we'll default to the enhanced trade partnership, and that will linger on for the best part of a decade, as it has with other trading partners. So I think there is a degree to which sometimes things happen sort of with a degree of momentum. Okay. And so I think it would happen like reasonably rapidly. Yeah.
Okay, John?
So there is another option, which the government has both governments have talked about an early harvest. So you know, you might get something quite quickly, but it wouldn't be the full thing.
Okay, so you want us to have a little bite of the cherry in like the autumn, and then the proper full FTA later on, basically.
Could happen. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's definitely cheating, John. But thank you for your insight, Sally. Don't invent a fourth option.
I'm going to go for yes and within a year, but only if the Home Office shifts position.
All right. Have you met the Home Office? Is that famously what they do? Anyway, right, come on, Sophie.
I think we're probably in the yes eventually, but not this year. And they always say when you go into negotiations, you know, as much of it is about the negotiations domestically as it is with your trading partner. So, you know, maybe the reason that they have this 1 year target is that, you know, it's quite clear India wants these mobility provisions. So maybe that's all kind of been agreed, but I think that's quite unlikely. And if it hasn't already been agreed internally, then I can't see them kind of resolving that. Finalising the entire negotiation and kind of getting it all signed off within a year.
Very good, and well done sticking yourself to what the actual options were. Right, let's bring up the results from those of you at home and see what you thought. Look at that. Well, the last one was North Korea, and this is like, I don't know what it is. This is definitely a Putin-style election rolling through here. Yeah, I think that's broadly, to be fair, I think that's probably broadly where we will be. Very good. That's a good level of consensus, a suspicious level, if anything. Right, now, thank you all for spending your time with us this morning. Enjoy Sue Gray. She will definitely be enjoying the afternoon. Thank you to our panel. I'll give you all a clap for informing us. I learned a lot from all of you this morning, so thank you very much indeed. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. Now we're going to find out whether this thing actually happens. So enjoy, looking forward to that, and see you all at a Resolution Foundation webinar soon. Thank you for listening to this Resolution Foundation event. You can find more episodes and the latest living standards research on the Resolution Foundation website.